hppodcraft.com.
Early on the evening of September 14th last, I stepped down onto the venerable brick platform of the Arkham Station of the Boston and Maine Railroad. I could have flown in, arriving at the fine new Arkham Airport north of town, where I am told a suburb of quite tasteful modern colonial homes now covers most of Meadow Hill. But I found the older conveyance convenient and congenial. Since I was carrying only a small valise and a flat, square cardboard box of trifling weight, I elected to walk the 3 blocks to the Arkham House. Midway across the old Garrison Street Bridge, which repaired and resurfaced only 10 years ago, spans the rushing Miskatonic there, I paused to survey the city from that modest eminence, setting down my valise and resting my hand on the old iron railing, while an occasional dinnertime car rumbled past close beside me.
This week we are closing out Librapril. Yeah, we're going to call it that because it is clever as it is easy to say.
Perfect.
With Fritz Leiber's To Arkham and the Stars.
That's right. We've imbibed our last Liber of the month. A bit of a wistful revisit to Arkham. And of course, we're talking about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're at hppodcraft.com and, of course, Patreon.
Our reader is once again Andrew Lehman, the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, putting the pep in that Nihilat Hotep. At the HPLHS, you can get all sorts of Lovecraftian merchandise and entertainment. They're actually doing this new thing now that's kind of like a 23andMe thing. You know, 23andMe, where you can send in a swab of your DNA
and
tell you your ancestry with this. You send some DNA into the HPLHS, and then they don't tell you what they do with it, and you never hear from them again. So it's the total weird fiction experience. Well worth the $900 price tag.
Whoa.
I sent some in, and I'm scared to death. I have no idea what they're going to do with it. Really fun stuff. But you can also head over there to tune into Andrew and Sean Branning's podcast, Voluminous.
Yeah.
In which they discuss the letters of H.P. Lovecraft. It's full of fun. It's full of insight. We'll link out to it in the show notes. Thank you, Andrew, for being a great reader once again.
This story, To Arkham and the Stars, was first written for the Dark Brotherhood and other pieces for Arkham House Publishing back in 1966.
The Dark Brotherhood being the Derleth story about the seven deadly Poes. We did a live show to talk about that one in Providence. This story being in an anthology with that story is like hitting the club with Chris Sarandon. You know what I mean? You might have all kinds of hot things going on with you, but you're still the ugly friend.
It's true.
It doesn't matter, you know? Outfits on point, your eyebrow game's looking good, you're a nuclear physicist, you're still swimming against the wake of that Sarandon speedboat.
It's pointless, really. I got this story from the 1992 anthology Tales of the Lovecraft Mythos.
Ah, see? Liber learned his lesson. Get it out of that one anthology. This is a lot more like hitting the club with me, you know?
Oh, boy, I do. Yeah.
I'm not saying I'll do okay.
Okay.
But it doesn't take much. You know, if you've got an interesting hat, you've probably won the night. If you've got a monocle or a wristwatch, you know.
So Arkham and the Stars seems to be set in the late 1950s or early 60s. It mentions Fidel Castro, the International Geophysical Year, 1957 to 58. So it's later than that at some point.
Yeah, we can say right at the top that there isn't much to this story. It's more of a mood piece with heavy references to Lovecraft stories, a lot like the last one in that respect.
Well, this almost feels like a sequel to The Terror from the Depths.
Yeah, it's definitely running with the idea that the mythos stuff is real, at least the characters and the larger events, and Lovecraft was a writer slash journalist who wrote and sensationalized it all in the pulps. Although that story, Terror from the Depths, had a setting and events and mysteries to uncover, whereas this uses the same conceit to create something different for a really narrow audience.
Boy, jeez,
Like I said, it's a mood piece, and overall the mood is, I don't want to say nostalgia, but it's got elements of that. It's not about glorifying how things were necessarily. It's more about noticing the change. Yeah. I don't know what the word is for that, but it's not really a sad mood as much as it's a weird mood. It's here's a thing I know, but it's different. This building stands, but the world has changed around it. That's the mood of it, I think, right?
Yeah.
And we'll explore this more as we go along, but I think it's an interesting human experience. If you live in any place long enough, you go through that. I mean, certainly Los Angeles changes all the time.
And yeah.
It's weird, you know, you see a place and then in my mind I'll map the same place 20 years ago, what I remember of it, over it.
Yeah.
And there's that momentary bit of dissonance. This is the same, but it's also different. And I think everybody can relate to that.
Sure, yeah. Going back to LA, when I visit you, you or see the place, mm-hmm. you really get a sense of how much things have actually changed in that short amount of time, especially going back to your hometown. Old buildings are knocked down or new businesses are in the places that used to be there, yeah. or there's totally new streets that were never there before. There's a bit of melancholy because things change, and it's usually good. You know, there's reasons for yeah. the changes, but also things aren't as you remember them being, and you are changing.
Right.
Of course, you're changing to become much older.
Well, I mean, it creates this very odd feeling. There is nostalgia and melancholy in it, but it's also just a sense of dislocation a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
This happens as well with the reading experience to an extent. You know, when you first read a story or book or body of work from an author, you visit those worlds and you visit those characters for the first time. And then like a hero yourself, you finish up and you return to your normal world, perhaps changed by the experience. But you bring those worlds and characters with you, mm-hmm. and now they have to coexist in your modern world, depending on what time and place you're reading it in. If you want to recommend the piece to somebody else, you have to contend with how has the world changed? How are the things that happen in here going to contend with what the values of a modern person might be? Mm-hmm. So you have that sense of change again. And we talk about this ad nauseum here because specifically with Lovecraft, get into that book, you go visit 1920s Arkham, you have a great time. Most people kind of remember the experience of discovering this writer for the first time. And then when you're done, you kind of look up off the page and you see how the world fits, the world of Lovecraft fits with the times today. There's a little bit of dissonance,
sure.
obviously.
Yeah.
And other writers come in, they use these concepts, they modernize them, and it's cool, but you are nostalgic for elements of the older world, even if it didn't age well. And Leiber's taking this larger mood concept and he's laser pointing it at the specific person who would be reading The Dark Brotherhood and other pieces or tales of the Lovecraft mythos. And I would say our listeners might be that person, so we might as well just get into it.
We have an unnamed narrator getting off the train in Arkham. We know that this is set in a more modern period because Arkham now has an airport.
Leiber is anything but inefficient. And that's the whole idea right there. Went to Arkham but took a train instead of a plane. You can't take a plane to Arkham. That's like using an ATM at Machu Picchu or something. You know, it's modernization you don't want to look at.
Sure.
But right away, you know, he's also noting that in that opening that bridges have been redone, tasteful suburbs have sprung up. Yeah. So right away he's saying, we're going to go visit this old place, but it's got a new face.
So the narrator walks through Arkham looking at the island in the Miskatonic River, the one that has the standing stones that were mentioned in The Dreams in the Witch House. He recalls reading about the bongo drumming delinquents that had been arrested on the island for doing a black mass. Beatnik cultists?
Looks like it. Pretty cool. I like that because those first paragraphs that we heard were saying the more things change, and this beatnik cultist is the more they stay the same. You know, because in Arkham, people are going to be doing cult rituals no matter
yeah.
what goes on.
Sure.
Know? No matter what the blanket trends are, you know, beneath those blankets, there's some hideous hearts beating.
Yeah. Now, this causes him to have a passing thought about Castro and the Cthulhu cult.
I thought that was interesting. A little bit of, you know, everybody's talking about Castro. In my day, Castro was a crazy cultist, not some cigar chomp. Desperate,
uh-huh.
or that's me in 1998. Ghetto superstar. This song, this is Islands in the Stream, guys. Doesn't anybody remember Islands in the Stream?
So he sees Hangman's Hill in the distance. Now it has a bunch of buildings around it. He goes through the Polish Quarter, which has become a nice housing development. The Poles aren't the foreigners that people were worrying about in Arkham anymore. It's those Puerto Ricans and Negroes.
So I thought that this was once again a demonstration of Leiber's efficiency. He basically gives a point of view on the racist issue with that one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Or a clause, or at least he signals awareness because this is the 60s. Lovecraft's views weren't quite as notorious as they are now, but
mm-hmm.
folks were still starting to contend with it. And in this sentence, it says, the newest foreigners to crowd the city are the Puerto Ricans and the Negroes. And foreigners isn't, it's quote unquote foreigners. It's in quotes. So it's letting us know that he thinks it's an incorrect categorization.
True. Yeah.
They're not real foreigners. So the sentence and that paragraph is making another, the more things stay the same argument. You know, there's always going to be a group that's considered the foreigners, but that's society's decision. It's not an inherent shortcoming of the group.
No.
Right? So the Irish are the foreigners, and then the Italians are the foreigners, and then the Spanish are the foreigners, the whatever it is, there's always a group of foreigners. It proves that there's nothing about the foreigners that puts them in that category other than the fact that they're new to the place.
Mm-hmm.
So in that very efficient clause, he's acknowledging that it's a problem, yet we should probably view Lovecraft as a man of his times and an average member of the human race despite his literary achievements, yet also that clause seems to say to me, I'm a man of my times and I know better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It
mm-hmm.
does all of that. which I found interesting.
Yeah, you're right, it does. The narrator's carrying a small box and a valise, and he's heading towards Miskatonic.
If this were a normal story, I think he would note the outside world, but be agonizing over this box. That would be the mystery we were meant to solve. Here, the box is important, but it likely doesn't contain a spirit zapper or haunted mask or anything.
No.
Arkham is the thing that's being noticed.
When he reaches campus, he notes the new administration building and beyond it, the Pikmin Nuclear Laboratory.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So Miskatonic is growing, adding new buildings, but the narrator is happy with the classic architecture that is being used.
And that they're being mindful of not disturbing old structures. They're like, we used reclaimed wood from the old dock to build the computer lab. There's strange etchings all over it, but it really gives it that authentic Arkham feel. I'm sure it'll be no trouble at all.
Mm-hmm. The sun is setting. It's twilight. The last bit, he notes, is the beginning of the phrase, tempora mutantur nos et mutantur in illis, meaning times are changed. We too are changed with them.
Muto meaning change, you know, mutate, immutable, mutilate, mutiny. When a kitten mews, it's actually trying to say, I'm growing up, I'm changing. It's trying to say mutate. That's where that comes
from. That's true, yeah. Scientific fact, that is. The narrator goes into the offices of the chairman of the Department of Literature. It is a silver-haired Professor Albert Wilmarth, hardly looking his more than 70 years. But he's gotten a bit creepy as the years have gone by.
Some call him unpleasantly rather than simply very erudite, it says. So he's kind of an intellectual snob. Yes. You know? Probably not that much fun to be around.
And this is the first thing that Wilmarth says to him.
I have been getting off a refutation of some whippersnapper's claim that the late young gentleman of Providence, who recorded so well so many of the weirder doings around Arkham, was a horrifying figure whose closest relation is with Peter Curtin, the Dusseldorf murderer, who admitted that his days in solitary confinement were spent conjuring up sexual sadistic fantasies. Great God, doesn't this sapless youngster know that all normal men have sexual sadistic fantasies? Even supposing that the literary fantasies of the late young gentleman had a deliberate sexual element and were indeed fantasies.
What? What? Where did this come from?
Instead of, well, Lovecraft's not around to defend his character, so sure. Obviously his characters are now defending him.
I had to do some digging into this paragraph because I'm like, what the hell's going on here? The young gentleman of Providence is obviously H.P. Lovecraft.
Yes.
Peter Curtin was known as the vampire of Dusseldorf or the Dusseldorf monster. He committed a number of sexual assaults and murders in 1929 in Dusseldorf. Surprisingly, he was caught and sentenced to death by guillotine because that was the method of capital punishment there at the time. I didn't realize that. But Carl Berg was the forensic scientist who called Peter Curtin the king of sexual perverts. And they called him a vampire because he attempted to drink the blood of some of his victims.
I do think it'd be really funny if it was like, they call him the vampire of Dusseldorf. He's from East Moline. Yeah. Also the king of sexual perverts.
He's the king.
Do they recognize it? Yeah.
Royalty.
That's a monarchical society. Perverts. So, there's no perverts in democracy.
So we find out later that this letter, at the end of this paragraph, this letter is going to this guy, Colin Wilson. I was like, okay, so maybe there's some explanation of that. I looked him up. He's a real author. He wrote true crime and occult paranormal mystical tales, that kind of thing. And I found out that this whole thing is documented on Wikipedia. It says, in The Strength to Dream, which came out in 1961, Wilson attacked H.P. Lovecraft as sick and as a bad writer who had rejected reality. But he grudgingly praised Lovecraft's story, The Shadow Out of Time, as capable science fiction. August Derleth, incensed by Wilson's treatment of Lovecraft in The Strength to Dream, then dared Wilson to write what became The Mind Parasites to expound his philosophical ideas in the guise of fiction. In the preface to The Mind Parasites, Wilson concedes that Lovecraft, far more than Hemingway or Faulkner or even Kafka, is a symbol of the outsider artist in the 20th century. Man, there is some serious stuff in this story. It is short, but it's so chock full of these in comments. Yeah. I don't know what you call them. They're not jokes. We do a Lovecraftian podcast, and most of the stuff is going over my head. I have to look up almost every sentence to go, okay, what the hell is he talking about here?
I know. Well, we might have talked about that before. I do remember hearing that before the whole Lovecraft resurgence in the 80s, you know, there was a lot of crap out there about who he was. And one rumor was this, that he was this sick dude who hung out with necrophiliacs or something.
All right.
I mean, it was something I'd heard even when I was just reading his stuff once in a while. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing something about whatever this made up rumor about, you know, it stuck. So yeah. I guess that Will Marth is just defending him.
I think a lot of it came out of L. Sprague de Camp's Lovecraft biography. Like he said a lot of stuff that wasn't true about Lovecraft.
Yeah, there was that as well, yeah. And I think we've talked about that stuff.
We have. Since this book came out in 1961, this story is definitely after or around 1961.
Whatever library just picked the most boring decade for a story setting.
So the narrator and Will Marth leave and they head for a meeting. They talk about the new buildings that were designed by Daniel Upton, the protagonist from The Thing on the Doorstep. Ever since he was given a clean bill of mental health and discharged with a verdict of justified homicide after he shot Asenath, or rather old Ephraim Waite, in the body of his friend Edward.
It's just common knowledge that you know, she was possessed by her grandpa. That was not one of Lovecraft's sensational touches.
So Will Marth also mentions young Danforth's another who's returned to us from the asylum, and permanently too, now that Morgan's research in mescaline and LSD has turned up those clever anti-hallucinogens. Danforth's gone into psychology, like Peasley's Wingate and old Peasley himself. It's a therapeutic vocation. Just now, he's deep in a paper on Asenath Waite, showing she's quite as much an anima figure, that is, devouring witch mother and glamorous fatal witch girl, as Carl Jung maintained in Haggard's Aisha and William Salone's Selina were. Those two books were stories from the early 20th century, Aisha and Selina. I had looked those up as well because I didn't know. I've never heard of those stories. They're novels, and they do have kind of a femme fatale character and as the antagonist in both of those stories.
In my day, Selena wasn't a fancy Latin pop star. It was an anima figure.
Yeah. The narrator counters with, one, Sloane's and Haggard's women were fictional, and two, Asenath was actually her father in her body, so she's not really a femme fatale.
Yeah.
And Wilmar's, of course. Yeah, sure. But old Ephraim lends just the proper fierce male component to the anima figure, and after you've spent an adult lifetime at Miskatonic, you discover you've developed a rather different understanding from the herds of the distinction between the imaginary and the real.
So that's so rude. I guess I'm getting that unpleasantly erudite thing, because basically with that comment, he's saying, you know, you have a rather different understanding from the herds. And he said this to correct him, which means he's basically going, you're part of the herd.
Yeah. They get to the faculty lounge. There, sitting at the round table, is Upton of mathematics, Gilman's former teacher, Francis Morgan of medicine, the sole survivor of the Dunwich War, Nathaniel Peasley, economics and psychology, who was the guy that went down to Australia in The Shadow Out of Time. You know, he was swamped out by the Yithian. And also Wingate, his son, who is in the psychology department as well. And of course, William Dyer of geology, who has been to the Mountains of Madness.
Right. I have to say, I've read all these Lovecraft stories, obviously. Mm-hmm. Have studied them more than most. This collection of characters, I couldn't remember who was who. I mean, thank God it says what story they're in.
Yeah.
But because Lovecraft doesn't really write characters, they're all sort of shells of people who are defined by what has happened to them.
Sure.
So I don't have this excitement that they're all together the way I would, you know. I mean, it sounds silly, but when the Avengers get together,
yeah.
How are these guys going to play off each other with their strong personalities? You don't feel that way with these guys because they're all sort of the same guy, yeah. You know.
Absolutely.
I don't think like, oh man, how will William Dyer and Francis Morgan manage to get along? They're a study in contrasts.
Oh boy.
Their paragraph reads more like meeting notes. You're like, okay, these are the people who were present. They're definitely people. Mm-hmm. And they were definitely there. Not that he doesn't, you know, big them up. He says, I looked around with a deep shiver of awe and feeling of personal unworthiness at the five elderly scholars and scientists, professors emeritus all, already seated at this figurative modern round table of high-minded battlers against worse than ogres and dragons, cosmic evil in all its monstrous manifestations. These aren't your daddy's D&D, bitches. Get ready for cosmic evil in your face.
Monstrous manifestations.
Wow. That's a rock.
Doesn't
power.
Really work to make these guys look cool, though,
no.
Because if you simplify that sentence, what it really says is here's five old dudes who want to stop all the interesting stuff from happening.
Oh, no, they fight bad guys. They fight terrible,
yeah,
horrible
but the
monsters.
Bad guys are the ones I read the story for.
Sure.
I don't really care what Dyer's doing.
So the narrator is warmly welcomed, but we don't get his name.
Yeah, it says, see here, what will you drink? Coffee, you say? Well, that's a prudent decision, but sometimes we need the other.
when our talk gets a little too far outside, if you take my meaning. But we're always glad to see intelligent-friendly visitors from the ordinary outside. Ha-ha! If you simplify that sentence, it's basically, we made up a bunch of invisible monsters as an excuse to get together and drink.
Yeah.
That's what's really going on here.
They're discussing how they no longer have courses on witchcraft or medieval metaphysics, being that it would be bad to let anybody in on that stuff.
Yeah, and the kids these days have all read Lovecraft, so that's all they want at Miskatonic now are occult courses.
Right, yeah. Morgan says that MIT wanted physiological drawings of the ancient ones, and that the skeleton of Brown Jenkins is not being let out to other universities, and people are thinking since it's not being let out that the whole thing might be a fake, like the Piltdown Man.
Right.
I'm not sure what the ancient ones are in reference to. It says, the ancient ones are not merely extraterrestrial, but extra cosmic. And I thought it was a reference to the other things, but no, because Dyer refers to them as the Arctic Old Ones. Now, there's a reference to the ancient ones in the Diary of Alonzo Typer, which was one I have not read in a while, but it says, I unfastened the blackened silver clasp and opened the yellowed leaves. A colored drawing fluttered out, the likeness of a monstrous creature resembling nothing so much as a squid, beaked and tentacled, with great yellow eyes, and with certain abominable approximations to the human form in its contours. So I think that's a pretty deep cut right there, that one.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
The Diary of Alonzo Typer? Man.
You haven't read that one in a while? I hit that one up on the reg, dude.
No, I honestly have not read it since we recorded the episode.
I got the first few paragraphs printed out, and I put them on the visor in my car. So if I'm in traffic, I'll flip it down.
Of course.
Quick Alonzo Typer read.
We also discover that the Mountains of Madness are kept secret from the world, and that the old ones keep humans away with some kind of hypnotic broadcast, so they're not bothered down there and in the Arctic. The old ones are on the side of humans, though the Shoggoths are not. It says, they're good fellows, I've always maintained. Scientists to the last, men! Which is, of course, a quote from At the Mountains of Madness.
Robert M. Price, who included this story in that anthology you mentioned, in the introduction said, it's proven to be a seminal mythos tale, as in it we first see the depiction of Miskatonic University as having, as it were, a mythos studies department. And yeah, this is Liber's attempt to codify things a bit, build more of a world. There's good guys and bad guys, even with the monsters, as others did as well. But I love his world because it means each author exists also in this world. Each has a point of view on what they think these things are based on their worldview.
Mm-hmm.
In our last episode, we were kind of talking about this. So nobody, including Lovecraft, is actually right about what the true intentions of all the old ones and stuff really are, although he was probably closest to the truth. But it's that kind of thing where, you know, like that Game of Thrones book where there was the comet and everybody was interpreting it differently.
Right.
A lot of these things are objectively true. These Miskatonic guys have seen all sorts of crazy stuff, but these authors are all imbuing it with motivations that may or may not be real.
Well, right, yeah. And we also discover that Wilmarth has some kind of alliance with the Mego, or the Plutonians, as they call them.
Right.
They're just about to talk about their involvement with the federal government when Ellery of the physics department comes in. Ellery was the guy who analyzed the arm of the statuette in the Witch House case.
Oh, you don't need to tell me that. Who can forget Ellery? These characters are unforgettable. You know what I should do is go back, for everybody's benefit, go back through Lovecraft, do a pass on the characters. Not a lot of work, just add little details in there so they stand out. You know, a clause here and there, Ellery of physics, who wore a pair of filthy 3D glasses and refused to remove them, stood up. Just little clauses like that. So if a guy shows up later with dirty 3D glasses, you'll go, oh, that's Ellery. I know who that is. Nathaniel Peasley opened the book, idly dusting away chronic dandruff from the Rainbow Bright t-shirt he favored at all times, and read the passage about invisible monsters. Okay, now I know who that guy is.
Yeah. It really helps. It really does.
Rainbow Bright fan. Got it.
And Dry Scalp. Ellery says that Caltech wants another sample of the statue. They're trying to figure out what all the metals are that are within it. Two of them are still eluding detection. They don't know what these metals are.
They're all very bothered that other scientists want to prove their stories. It seems. Julie does suggest it's a drinking club.
They talk about the nuclear laboratory at Miskatonic and how it has always been privately funded and not beholden to the U.S. government or any other body. He does mention the University of Chicago in the early days of the Manhattan Project wanted a sample of the meteor that fell there in Arkham, which is now the Arkham Reservoir. So that's a Colorado Space reference. Of course, the meteor evaporated, and they are all now fine drinking out of the Arkham Reservoir, so it doesn't seem to have affected any of them because they've been doing it for years.
Wilmarth acknowledges they've been drinking from it, and it says, I found myself hating him for the unpleasant knowingness of his chuckle. He knows it might have messed them up, or he's thinking about the nascent Arkham Springs company that he's just founded. Nobody believes in the 60s that folks would buy a plastic bottle of tap water from another municipality, but he's seen into man's insanity, and he knows it's something that might manifest in the future.
They say the U.S. government wants stuff from them, even the Necronomicon, but they don't let them have anything.
The military, it says they got this idea they'd discover in the Necronomicon terror weapons worse than the H-bomb and the intercontinental ballistic missile. Man, I want to see that story. I want to see that weaponized. And I was thinking about it, actually. You can kind of take any work of literature and do a sequel where the military weaponizes it in some way. It's just an easy way to do a sequel to anything. I mean, obviously it works for something like Lovecraft, but you could even do My Fair Lady, you know.
What? Wow.
We've got this group of gruff Navy SEALs that are going to infiltrate this country. The problem is they have to go to a fancy dinner and get intel. So, Henry Higgins, you need to see this charm offensive out. You need to participate to make sure they're all polite and using their manners. See?
Okay, there you go. Makes sense.
Any story, point military proven. Weaponizes it. Yeah.
So the clock strikes midnight and the narrator gets up to address them all. It's September 15th and he wants to go out to the burying ground to lay a wreath. That was what was in his box at the grave of Armitage. It is the anniversary of defeating the Dunwich Horror. Wilmarth says that he'll go with him, but nobody else will.
We found the perfect place for our secret military base on Golden Pond. Sorry. Yes, this is the big reveal of the story. What's in the box? It's a wreath, not a dangerous artifact, after all. It's a memento to acknowledge sacrifice. And in the story, it's only a couple of diehards who go to put this wreath on the grave. That was really sad that even though you had this drinking club of old Mythos veterans, nobody would go with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Wilmarth and our protagonist. But I think Liber in this anthology is saying, hey, not a lot of people know who this Lovecraft guy is, but we know what he contributed. And it's worth taking a break from the storytelling and reinvention to just sit in this old world for a second and admire it. Acknowledged it's changed, but let's look for the bits of what was special in the midst of all the new facades, you know? Because I don't know what other stories were in that anthology, but I'm assuming they were a lot of updated mythos stuff.
Yeah.
So I think we need to think of the story in the context of the Seven Deadly Poes and other things that were going on around it. You know, I think that this is just a little breath of, hey, remember why we like this stuff, guys? Yeah. I'm not going to tell you any stories in it. I just want to take you back here and let's look at it for a second.
So on their walk to the graveyard, the narrator asks about the Plutonians. When Wilmarth first met them, it was at almost the exact time as the Dunwich Horror happened. Like, chronologically speaking, it was within a day or two of each other. And he asks, was this a coincidence? And Wilmarth says, no. The Plutonians, or Ugothians, they aren't really all that evil.
From the hints they've given me, it appears that the Plutonians had got wind of Wilbur Whateley's intention of letting in the Ancient Ones, and were preparing to block them by winning more human confederates, especially here at Miskatonic and so on. None of us realized it, but we were brushing the fringes of an intercosmic war. This revelation left me speechless, and it was not until the protesting black-painted iron gate had been pushed open and we stood among the age-darkened moonlit headstones that our conversation was resumed. As I reverently lifted Armitage's wreath from its container, Wilmarth gripped me by the elbow, and speaking almost into my ear, said with a quiet intensity, "There is another piece of information the Plutonians have supplied me, which I believe I should share with you. You may not be willing to credit it at first. I wasn't. But now I've come to believe it. You know the Plutonians' trick of extracting the living brains of beings unable to fly through space, preserving those brains immortally in metal canisters and carrying them about with them throughout the cosmos to see via the proper instruments and hear and comment on its secrets. Well, I'm afraid this will give you a nasty shock, but tell yourself there's a good side to it, for there is. On the night of March 14th, 1937, when the young gentleman lay dying in the Rhode Island hospital, a secret entry was made into the Jane Brown wing, and to use his words, or rather mine, his brain was removed by fissions so adroit that it would be crude to call the operation surgery. So that he is now flying some course between Hydra and Polaris, safe in the arms of a night gaunt, reveling forever in the wonders of the universe he deeply loved. And with a gesture dignified yet grand, Wilmarth lifted his arm toward the North Star, where it faintly shone in the gray sky high above Meadow Hill and the Miskatonic. I shivered with mixed emotions. Suddenly the sky was full. I knew now the deeper reason I had all evening wanted to shudder at my conductor. Yet was deeply happy that it was a reason by which I could respect him the more. Arm in arm, we moved toward the simple grave of Dr. Armitage.
And that's the end.
Yeah, it's like any of the things people tell each other at a grave. You know, she's up there looking down. He's running around with his dog right now. Mm-hmm. He's playing cards with Aunt Shifty. Except this is contextualized into Lovecraft's cosmos. You know what Shifty. I mean? He's up there running around in a brain case, just like he always dreamed, you know? I don't know.
I'm Aunt not Shifty. Sure how I feel about this story. I mean,
yeah.
It's not really a story at all. It's more like an epilogue to another story. It's like tying up some loose ends and being nostalgic about the past.
I think it probably works best in the context of that anthology. But in that respect, it's great at what it does, I think. It shows a master writer creating the exact effect that he wanted for a very narrow audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, after reading the stuff this month of the Lovecraft Circle, I'm going to go ahead and give Leiber the best overall writer award.
Wow, yeah.
I think that he can take whatever he wants out of the tool belt and execute on it however he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe followed by Robert Block. But I'm going to say overall... I'm going to say overall writer because there's people like Robert E. Howard gets best adjective.
Sure, of course, yeah.
But I'm really impressed by him. I'm a Belieber, that's for sure.
I'm definitely a Belieber.
And this was a great transition into next month in which we're going to revisit Lovecraft.
Yeah, a lot of folks have been asking us to do this, going back to some of the older Lovecraft stories that we covered 10 years ago. Look at them with a bit of hindsight now that we have.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a little bit more interesting for us to... not only look at the stories themselves, but look at our shows and the people we were back then and what was going on, and also kind of mirror it to some newer things that are going on, new movies, newer fiction, try and bring all that stuff together. One of the stories that we're talked about revisiting is The Color Out of Space, because that has recently been adapted into a feature film.
That's right. It's all in honor of our 500th episode, which will be hitting newsstands next month. That's how you say it, right? And we'll be starting out with The Color Out of Space. And as Chris said, we'll be listening to our old shows and watching new movies and all kinds of stuff like that. It's going to be a lot of fun. Tune in for that. I want to thank Andrew for being a great reader,
oh
as always.
God.
Remember, you can send HPLHS your DNA for a truly weird experience. They don't send you a kit first. You're just supposed to get the DNA to them on your own. So whatever from your body you can fit in an envelope, do it. Mail it to the HPLHS immediately. Attention, Andrew Lehman. I'm not saying he's going to respond, but he wants to see what you got. And while you're waiting for results, you can listen to Voluminous.
Oh, boy. Yeah, Voluminous is a great podcast. Super insightful and interesting. If you're a fan of this show, definitely give this a listen.
I want to thank some patrons. I want to start by thanking Stacey Schumacher.
I'd like to thank Stephen Riggs.
Tom Lewis, thank you so much.
Christopher Barnes, Kip.
Hey. I love Kip.
I love him.
I really do. John Morgan, thank you.
I'd like to thank Ken Ewan.
Maddie Summers, thank you so much.
J.M. Dragunas, thank you.
Let's all thank you.
And Edward Madsen, thank you so much.
I can't believe I'm saying this. We will be back next with some H.P. Lovecraft.
Woo!
Here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, I have been Chad Fife.
And I'm Chris Leike, and we are at HPPodcraft.com.
HPPodcraft.com.